The history of Rocky Horror is a history of cinema.
For everything you like about Rocky Horror, there was at least one film that inspired it.
And we're going to review them all on Episode Zero.
Everybody, and welcome back to Episode Zero, the Rocky Horror Picture Show podcast, where we don't really talk about the Rocky Horror Picture Show. My name is William Bibbiani. I'm a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic, and you can call me Doctor. Dr. Everett Scott.
Brad! Yeah, this is the podcast where we look at a pop culture sensation, an ongoing pop culture mainstay, something that people consider very influential, and look at the various films that influenced that in the first place. We previously spent 20 episodes talking about Star Wars, and we are about halfway through, give or take. We don't actually have, like, a number.
But this isn't like TV, where every season is, quote, season is going to be 20 episodes long.
It's the first one happened to be 20.
As long as we like.
This first one happened to be 20. This is about, like, episode 9 or 10 of the Rocky Horror Picture Show podcast, and Rocky Horror is, you know, it's a cult icon. Mm-hmm. It's one of the great midnight movies. It's a classic musical. It is really in your face.
Yeah.
And
super queer.
Yeah, it's very queer. Mm. It's very queer. Well, Hollywood didn't have a long history of being in your face about queerness, did it?
It didn't, but with the right kind of eyes, we talked on previous episodes about how, queer characters and queer relationships had to be coded in Hollywood films, largely because of the Hays Code. Gay characters just weren't allowed on screen.
And again, if this is your first episode, we've mentioned it before, but in a nutshell, a lot of places were starting to censor Hollywood movies the whole time, but in the early 1930s, Hollywood decided that if people are going to censor our movies for their content, we're worried about the government stepping in and making it a whole thing, so we're going to create a system of self-censorship in which all of the movies that are produced by mainstream Hollywood, which was at the time pretty much everything, have to follow a certain code of conduct. Kissing can only be this long, and you cannot open your mouth. We cannot show divorce in a positive light. Extremely conservative values. And as a result, a lot of things were either pushed to the side if they were being shown more often before, stuff like sex and nudity and violence, and there was just less of it, or if it was less, it was a lot less graphic. And a lot of topics and themes and even just people, the types of characters you see in stories, had to either be marginalized or written off or hidden. And in texts where, if you know what you're looking at, you know exactly what's going on. And if you are blithely ignorant that there are people who are not heterosexual, middle-class Christians, you might not even notice that you're watching a movie that is about queerness.
Yeah. Rope, the 1948 Alfred Hitchcock movie, is about a gay couple.
Yep.
Unabashedly. Now, they don't never say, we live together, or we're boyfriends.
I think they explicitly live together. Aren't they roommates? I think they're clearly roommates.
They're roommates.
I know, but I'm just saying, they do live together. They do live together.
They do live together, yeah. But they don't say that they're a couple, and they don't kiss, and they don't hold hands, or do or say anything explicit. But when they're talking about murder, it sounds very sexual, and it doesn't hurt that the two actors, Farley Granger and the other one. John Dahl.
Yeah.
Farley Granger and John Dahl were gay. In fact, Farley Granger was having a relationship with a screenwriter of this movie at the time.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
They are a gay couple, and this is about as explicitly gay as I think Hollywood was allowed to get in the late 1940s. Hitchcock actually put a lot of queer-coded characters in his movies.
Yep. Martin Landau, but, very famously in North by Northwest, was a great character.
Or Strangers on a Train is could be argued rather easily that that's about an unrequited crush that a man has on another man.
Mm-hmm.
Curiously enough, the straight quote straight reading character in that film is played by Farley Granger. But Rope is about specifically about a queer couple. They're living together, and I feel like the coding almost isn't even there.
It's very explicit. Once you know that it's there, and honestly, if you're old enough to like just read subtext, like I first saw this movie when I was rather young, and I think the subtext, I would just look at it as a story of murder. And then once I got even remotely older, I was like, okay, I see what's going on here. And it opened up the whole film, and it made it a lot more fascinating. And before I play a clip of this, I also want to talk about something very technical that's very interesting about Rope. Rope is a film directed by Alfred Hitchcock.
And it's got a gimmick.
Yep. A lot of Alfred Hitchcock movies have a gimmick. Now, I feel like there is a weird stigma against quote-unquote gimmick movies, because a lot of people assume that when you call something a gimmick movie, you are implying that there's nothing there but a gimmick. Bullshit. A lot of movies have a gimmick and are also good movies. In case in point, Rope, which I think is a very excellent movie for the most part. But it has a really interesting gimmick for the 1940s, back when cameras were gigantic, and the idea of long takes and long camera moves was actually really difficult to pull off. Rope is a film from 1948, it's Alfred Hitchcock's first color movie, and it is filmed so that it looks like, almost, it's filmed in one long take.
These days, that's almost not impressive anymore.
No, because
you can use all this kind of digital trickery to just erase all of the edits. Yeah. Or
Birdman is edited out the wazoo. It just looks like it's not edited. Yeah, and it's complicated, and I give them a lot of credit for it, but they didn't do it all in one take.
I would have been more impressed if they did. The first film I remember seeing that did this trick other than Rope was Russian Ark, which is in the early 2000s.
Oh, really?
It's an Alexander Sokurov movie, and it takes place in the Hermitage, and it sort of traces the history of all of Russia, and it goes into all of the rooms in the Winter Palace, and there's orchestras playing, and there's dancers dancing, and there's this host character is a little out of time explaining to other characters what's going on in Russian history. But the reason that was so revolutionary was because camera technology had finally advanced to the point where you could shoot an entire 90-minute film without having to edit.
Yeah.
You could store it in one take.
Yeah, initially, cinema cameras actually had film in them. You couldn't put an entire movie's worth film in there. It wouldn't fit.
Yeah.
It was huge.
A 90-minute film, that's going to be five reels. And a reel of film that could fit in a camera in 1948 was only about 10 minutes long. It was like 10 to 12 minutes.
Yeah.
So that was the restriction with Hitchcock's edits. He could only do it in like 10-minute takes.
No, they're still very complicated takes.
And
but
for the most part, he would like zoom into Farley Granger's back.
Yeah, like a character would walk in front of the camera.
Would go black for just a moment, and you can tell that's where he had to hide the edit.
It's not subtle, but it does work. And there's a couple of really hard edits that are just chef's kiss. I think the first time I saw this gimmick outside of Rope, which I saw first, was in a pretty cool film that nobody talks about anymore called Running Time, which is Bruce Campbell plays a former an ex-con who gets out of prison, and as soon as he gets out of prison, he gets in the back of a car and they're right off to the next heist. So it's real it's really intense, and I think it's an underrated film and people don't talk about it very much, and I wish they would. But the plot of Rope, real fast, is Farley Granger and John Dahl have decided that they are going to live a lifestyle beyond what anyone else conceives of as possible. They're going to live the ultimate lifestyle of murder. They're going to feel like they are superior to other people and they can murder if they choose to. At the beginning of the film, they kill a guy.
The opening shot of the movie.
Well, there's the opening. Well, there's the credits,
there's the first edit. That's the one edit in the movie.
Yeah,
like deliberate edit where we're looking at the exterior of their apartment. Yeah. Cut. Boom. We're inside. David's being strangled.
Yeah, dude dies. They shove him in like a big cabinet, and then they close it up, and then that's where David is for the rest of the movie. And then they invite David's whole, all of David's friends and family over for a dinner party.
Now, if they had done this in one take, that actor would have had to stay in that cabinet throughout the whole movie.
Well, the set is actually really complicated, and I don't think that's necessarily the case.
That's true. They would have panned away. Yeah, could have gone.
They panned away. He moves away. So here's the deal. It's basically an apartment set. It's three rooms, living room, sort of a hallway, and a kitchen. We don't spend a lot of time in the kitchen. It's mostly in the living room. And it's mostly just, like, there's a fourth wall that is missing. We hardly ever see it. And as the camera moves in and out and to the left and to the right and comes up with interesting framings, and we start seeing, like, interesting details, like different pictures take on different connotations depending on who's standing in front of them and what's going on in the plot. As the camera moves away from one thing, the rest of the set can be disassembled so that when the camera returns, it can take on an entirely new location. And this is also
before the innovation of the Steadicam. So it's not somebody holding the camera. These were gigantic machines that had to be wheeled around.
Exactly. And also outside of their window, there is an incredibly elaborate miniature New York City. This is not just like one backdrop. It's not a painting. It's not some kind of rear screen projection. It's a bunch of miniatures, and the miniatures are they have smoking chimney stacks. They have neon lights that go on and off. The movie takes place at sunset, so the lighting in the film changes dramatically. And towards the end of the movie, neon lights start like flying in through the windows. It's a complicated production. So if they wanted to, they could have totally put a trap door in there for David to get out of if they were able to do this all in one take. I want to play a clip from this one because I was going to just like do our usual thing where we say the title and then we cut to a clip from the trailer. This one's weird, though, because it's all done in one take. It was kind of hard to do a conventional trailer. The other thing that's kind of neat about it, the trailer is a prequel to the film. So there's a little bit of a prequel thing showing about David about going to his next appointment. And then Jimmy Stewart breaks the fourth wall and talks about this really cool thing he did. So let's take a listen to the trailer for Rope.
I personally consider us engaged as of now. Congratulations.
David, no.
Look, you can say yes in a taxi. I have a 2:30 appointment.
I'm staying right here.
Oh, afraid you'll say yes?
I'll see you tonight at Brandon's party.
Okay. You can say yes, sir, just as well as in a taxi. Goodbye, darling.
Bye.
That's the last time she ever saw him alive. And that's the last time you'll ever see him alive. What happened to David Kentley changed my life completely and the lives of seven others. Janet Walker, Henry Kentley, the boy's father, his aunt, Mrs. Atwater, his best friend, Kenneth Lawrence, a housekeeper named Mrs. Wilson, and the two who were responsible for everything, Brandon Shaw and Philip Morgan.
Rope.
They should have called it David. I think they really should have called it David. Because rope is the weapon. They strangle David with the rope. The Farley Granger and John Dahl characters.
You don't think that's also a metaphor for like they're tying a noose around their necks?
I get it. Just there's so much mention of David, and he's mentioned by name so frequently.
What about where's David? Like with like a question mark.
I think what happened to David might have been a little bit more sinister. Dinner with David. This is based on a play from the 20s, and in the play. From what I understand, and this is, I haven't seen the play or read it, but I did a little reading on it. And from what I understand, the Jimmy Stewart character wasn't their teacher. Farley Granger and John Dahl are out of college. They're big fans of Friedrich Nietzsche, who's been floating around in the popular consciousness a lot thanks to Adolf Hitler, and who's named in this movie, about this misinterpretation of Nietzsche, who he said that... and I have read Nietzsche, that you are essentially trying to realize, in Nietzsche's words, your will to power. That means you're a more powerful mentally person. And those who do not complement your mental strength are not people you should have in your life. Yeah,
they're lesser than.
He preached a philosophy of the self. Yourself is the most important thing. Anything outside of you is a form of asceticism. Religions, sciences, other relationships, just cut them all out. Become the strong mental being that you can.
And the byproduct of that is that your morality, or whatever you consider morality, becomes superior to anyone else's.
Exactly.
You can ignore their morality.
The idea is, morality is a set of all of these, like, old social strictures. The idea of helping others over yourself is, Nietzsche said, a kind of form of mental illness. And he did believe, and at least he wrote, that there are people who are just mentally stronger than others. Mm-hmm. And they are the ones who are going to realize their will to power. Others are not. He called them the herd.
I'm gonna editorialize a little bit here.
All right.
Bullshit.
Well,
it's a lot of bullshit in there.
There's every philosopher is a big mixture of interesting ideas and bullshit. Another thing that you like a big hunk of rock salt that you have to take with Nietzsche is that he was blazingly sexist.
Yeah,
he believed that women could not achieve this kind of mental acuity that he was talking about. And I've heard some women talk very eloquently about how. That's BS. Here's the interesting parts of these things, but you can't really take all of Nietzsche at once.
That
was taken by the Third Reich and almost deliberately misinterpreted to mean, well, if there are people who are more mentally acute and who are essentially naturally stronger than others, surely that means we can start calling our shots and call ourselves the strong ones. If we are the superior beings, anything we do previously good or previously evil by the old morality is going to be good because we said it is.
Yeah.
And that leads to concepts of the master race. That's not Nietzsche's philosophy. That's the popular misinterpretation, and that's the takeaway.
I'm not a fan of Nietzsche in general, but obviously, and that's really what Rope is about in many respects.
Yeah, well, that's why I bring it up because they talk about Nietzsche, they talk about how it was misinterpreted by Hitler, and how a lot of young hotshot philosophy students. Might take the wrong lessons from Nietzsche, which is exactly what happens in this film.
Yeah, so...
The reason our two protagonists are killing David is just for the intellectual thrill of it, to prove that they can get away with it because they're smarter and they kind of deserve to.
Yeah.
They are... If they're capable of achieving that thrill, then it is morally right.
Yeah, and the primary... Well, they're the antagonists, but I hesitate to say that Jimmy Stewart is particularly the protagonist because he actually has a lot to answer for. But their foil, if you will, is their former professor, played by Jimmy Stewart, who is strongly implied to have had a sexual relationship with at least John Dahl.
With Farley Granger.
Really? I assume both.
Oh,
well, anyway.
In the original play, that character was another student of theirs. And he's described as being, like, sort of effeminate.
Okay. In the movie, he's played by James Stewart, significantly older than John Dahl and Farley Granger, and he is portrayed as a former professor of theirs who had intellectualized the idea, sort of inspired by Nietzsche, that murder, the act of merely eliminating someone's life if they are in your way, is positive, that it is something that is... indicative of your own personal strength and their personal weakness. It seems like he's joking about it, but he's taking it from a
place of cynicism. Like he's not an actual nihilist.
Yeah, he's speaking in hypotheticals, but he also refuses to say that he's joking because on some level he does kind of believe in the basic idea of superiority. But the plot of the movie is that someone has taken his ideas, his philosophical musings, and literalized them and become genuine monsters. Mm. And that, I think, is where this takes on a grander sort of political scheme.
Yeah.
The idea, because the play was written before World War II. The play was written in 1929. The movie was actually adapted by a screenwriter, author Arthur Lawrence, but also by Hume Cronin, an actor who been a ton of stuff.
I knew from like Cocoon.
Yeah. And I think he was in Shadow of a Doubt. I think that was the Hitchcock movie he was in.
Oh, was he? Okay.
Yeah. So it's got this weird pedigree, but now that it's like 20, yeah, about 20 years later, that kind of conversation has taken on a dramatically different turn, or at the very least, there's now context which has to be addressed. It is the elephant in the room.
Yeah.
The other context, which is super important, and it is indeed the inspiration for the play, is Leopold and Loeb.
Yeah, the real life murderers.
Yeah, and these were this was a huge court case in the early part of the 20th century.
Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb killed a 14-year-old boy.
Yeah.
And I believe the idea was they were simply trying to commit the perfect crime.
Yeah, they were just trying to see if they could get away with it, is the idea. And obviously that it was absolutely horrifying and shocking. The idea that murder would be committed not out of passion or even in order to gain something, but just to be done for its own sake was sort of eerily fascinating and has been turned into a wide variety of films. There's a pretty decent one with Orson Welles and Dean Stockwell called Compulsion, which I quite like. Mm.
I haven't seen Compulsion.
It's quite good. It's not amazing filmmaking, but the storytelling is good, and Dean Stockwell and Welles are particularly good in it.
I did see Murder by Numbers, the Sandra Bullock movie.
that's not a good movie.
Or it's Leopold and Loeb, Michael Pitt and Ryan Gosling.
Yeah,
are the and they were younger at this one. They're like teenagers.
Oh, yeah, but Gosling was like barely out of like Remember the Titans at this time. Yeah, he was in Remember the Titans, right? Am I crazy? Am I remembering the Titans?
I never saw the Titans. I never met them, so I can't remember them.
I'm checking this out. People are gonna get really mad at me.
But yeah, Leopold and Loeb also cited Nietzsche.
He was in Remember the Titans. Remember the Titans,
I don't know the actual facts of the case if Leopold and Loeb were also lovers, but yeah, these characters in Rope were clearly modeled after Leopold and Loeb. Real-life murders that inspired a lot of movies, similar to the way Ed Gein inspired things like The Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Or Psycho.
Psycho.
Golly,
Hitchcock sure loved murder. He was fascinated by murder. He was fascinated by crime. And the idea of contemplating actually committing these ultimate crimes was an intellectual thrill for a filmmaker like Hitchcock.
I think that's
because it comes up time and time again in a lot of his movies.
Yeah. I feel like that's something that Hitchcock was in. I feel like something that one of the things that makes Hitchcock's films still resonate beyond other, sort of pulpy kind of thrillers is the idea that people aren't just doing things, they're thinking about them.
Yeah.
And I feel like too often these sort of compulsions or impulses or even fascinations people have in movies, they're just sort of considered like, oh, that's in their character or something. Or there's some sort of glib sort of motivation for it. Well, when I was a child, I was hurt by a snowman, and now I am the snowman. I forget how that movie ended, but
you're talking about the movie The Snowman.
That movie is a mess.
One day I got a note that said, "Dear Mr. Sir," so I wrote a note that said, "Dear Mr. Police."
I think Hitchcock was fascinated by people who are driven to do something and then think about it. And then want to talk about it.
Yeah.
And then be like, I'm so alone in my fascination with murder. Will you talk murder with me? And then maybe we'll do one. Oh, no, we're not going to do one? Okay. Wink. No wink? Okay, never mind.
Well, and I think this is really common. I think a lot of people think about death and crime and morbid things. It's a natural impulse.
Again,
and
true crime is a popular genre. Yeah. Law and Order is still on the air. People are interested in crime.
Did you have like sort of a gloomy goth phase when you were a teen?
Now.
Oh, it's now? Okay.
I'm not really, I've always said, I'm phobic of death, like in the abstract, but I've always been interested in sort of in real life crime. Like true crime doesn't really interest me that much because it's a little too real. I'm so overwhelmed by empathy for the people who suffer that I can't do it. But in a movie or a TV series or even something that's sort of fictionalized like this, I can detach myself just enough that I can really appreciate sort of the morbid fascination of it. But that's never gone away. I'm always interested in this kind of movie.
Morbid fascination has always been a big part of my life. Catch me at age 17 or 18. You'll find me at Necromance on Melrose, poking through. It's like, ooh, if I had enough money, I could buy a real deer skull. And here's like a full all these morbid things from like pathology labs that they could sell to the public legally.
Yeah.
So, you know, you could actually get human bones under the certain circumstances.
Yeah, they have to be, you know, in the follow all the rules and laws about it. But yeah, necromancy is, I don't know if people know what that is outside of LA, but
no, it's a shop on Melrose here in West Hollywood that's been there for a good number of years, actually. I'm surprised it's still open.
I hope it's still open. It's one of those places I haven't driven past since the pandemic started, but I hope they're doing okay.
But they sold like a lot of taxidermied animals and animal parts, but also like, you know, medical journals and disease journals and like t-shirts with gravestones on it. It was all very like goth, deathy, morbid stuff. And I loved that store, and I went there as often as I could. And I was fantasizing about, hey, when I'm rich enough, I can get a real human skull and just carry it around. Because I'm that gloomy. Oh, now I'm going to put on my music. Weird Al Yankovic. It's like, it was a walking contradiction. like really morbid and really absurd. There was no middle ground.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same way.
But yeah, I think Hitchcock was one of those people. And so he was constantly interested in talking about it.
Yeah.
And intellectualizing it.
Well,
so
again,
this
he's a storyteller as well. Yeah. So all of his movies are about murder. These are kind of
But they're about people who are interested in murder.
Well, that's true. But if you think about it, the conversations that people have in Rope about murder, getting away with murder, how we feel about committing murder, what's going to happen after we commit the murder, what's the perfect way to dispose of a body. These are all conversations that people are having while they make movies about murder.
Mm.
There's a really good movie. I want more people to see this because it's a really interesting film and nobody talks about it. I want to make sure I get the cast right. It's a movie called The Gazebo.
Just The Gazebo.
Yeah, it's 1959. It stars Glenn Ford and Debbie Reynolds. Glenn Ford plays a screenwriter. Debbie Reynolds plays his actress wife. And someone is blackmailing them.
Oh, you know what? I saw some of this with the sound off in a bar.
Are you kidding me?
No. When I was on vacation in Denver, funny. Colorado, I went into this little dive bar and they had that on the TV.
It's actually a good movie, but the plot is they're being blackmailed. She doesn't know. Someone's going to say, before you were married, before your wife had this like fancy movie star career, she did some salacious photo shoots. And if you don't want these photographs to come out, you'll give me all this money. And Glenn Ford is just at the end of his rope, and so he kills the guy. And now he's alone in his house at night and he can't figure out what the hell to do. And then someone calls him on the phone and it's Alfred Hitchcock. He does not make a cameo, but he does say Alfred Hitchcock is on the phone.
Oh, that's funny.
Hey, Hitch. Yeah, I'm in the middle of this screenplay. Hey, maybe you can help me out. If you had a dead body in your living room and you had to dispose of it real fast before your wife came home, what would you do? I have a backyard. Okay. Well, I don't have a shovel, though. I could use the shovel from the fireplace. Thanks, Hitch. Click. Exact same thing. It's really great.
So this is a morbid thought exercise, not just from the characters, but from the filmmaker about how a murder would go down practically.
Yeah. So again, they kill David right away. They put him in the big box, and immediately we see the big difference in the sort of not character, because they're both people who would go through with this, but the demeanor.
Mm.
Of the two murderers. And so John Dahl is very cool and collected, and he's having a smoke like he just had great sex. He's just like, oh, that's the stuff. That was good murder. And Farley Granger is already traumatized by what they've done. He agreed to do it. He consciously made the decision to do it, and he is completely unprepared for it, and guilt is overtaking him, and he's panicking, and they've already planned as the sort of pièce de résistance to invite his friends and family over for a party. And everyone's going to be like, where's David? And they're going to be like,
I don't know.
And Farley Granger is going to lose his shit progressively over the night.
Who killed David? Not me. So like, they chase the dotted line around. So
the idea is we're kind of waiting to see when Farley Granger is going to crack. And while we're waiting for Farley Granger to crack, John Dahl is progressively being cuter and cuter. Like the rope that they strangled David with, at one point he wraps up some books and says to David's father, oh, here are these books you wanted to borrow, and he just gives him the murder weapon.
Yep.
Lets him go home with it, and he's gonna know that's in like a drawer somewhere in his house the rest of his life, and he's gonna go like Muttley the dog but murderous. And so, yeah, it's a big pressure cooker, and everyone's there. Everyone keeps, like, interacting with the table. They put food on the table for people to, like, have snacks. And so, like, here's David's fiance, and she's just like, yeah, I just wonder where David is here. Munch, 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 munch. And it's so ghoulish. It's so ghoulish and gross.
It's not quite as ghoulish as something like in Titus Andronicus, where they cook actually... him and feed him to like the guests or anything.
No, that would be different.
That's another level.
Yeah. But it's still ghoulish, though.
And it's something... that would have been a little bit more Rocky Horror inflected, however.
Yeah, because, again, we usually say this for the end, but let's just talk about the elephant in the room. Beyond the fact that we're looking at how Hollywood was portraying queerness in the 1940s and how free Rocky Horror became to celebrate queerness really openly, there's also a very key centerpiece in the Rocky Horror Picture Show where everyone's eating dinner, everyone's like, hey, where's Meatloaf? Yeah. And then, while they're talking about him...
That's a rather tender subject. Another slice, anyone?
Yeah, it turns out they're all eating Meatloaf. The guy, not the meat.
Eddie is the character's name.
I mean, they might have turned him into a Meatloaf. I don't actually recall what's on the plate.
And no, then it's this giant roast-looking thing.
Yeah, and then at some point, Frankenfurter pulls off the whole tablecloth, and they're just there's Eddie's corpse right there.
It's like ripped apart corpse and underneath the tablecloth.
Yeah, it's very, very ghoulish. It's also like the worst paced scene in the whole movie.
When they perform that scene live for the live Rocky Horror casts, they just fuck around on stage. Like there's nothing going on. The characters are sitting still. There's no song. There's a lot of dead air. So there's just all kinds of
eating awkwardly,
all kind of jokes. So the cast just sits down on the stage and they just start snacking. they're not matching anything. They're not making any jokes. Yeah. It's their intermission essentially. Right.
But Rope, which is the feature length version of that scene, is impossibly gripping.
Mm.
It's really excellent. It feels like a stage play because, you know, there's always that one wall missing.
Yeah. So and he filmed it live to look like it's live, like it's one theatrical experience.
Exactly. There's a couple of takes in the middle. There's one big cut in the middle. Usually they're trying to hide them. Sometimes they're more effective than others. But there's one cut in the middle where, they're having the party and John Dahl knows exactly what's going on and he's having the time of his life. And Farley Granger is, every time John Dahl hints that they've killed somebody euphemistically or talks about where David is, oh, I have no idea where he could be. Maybe you should go after his fiance. Something tells me you have a chance.
I think he's out of the picture now.
Cough. In fact, murdered a guy.
You might say we just ate Uter and he's in our stomachs right now. Oh, wait, scratch that last one.
It's a Simpsons reference. But there's this bit where all of a sudden, Farley Granger is the only one who knows the inner meaning of all of these remarks. Mm. And now James Stewart is there. And again, James Stewart is the one who gave him the idea.
And Farley Granger's freaking out. Like, there's a scene where somebody walks in and says, where's David? And he crushes a glass in his hand.
And he starts blood all over. John Dahl says something really on the nose. And Farley Granger has a panic moment, and then all of a sudden, boom, our first real cut. Mm. Unabashed, unapologetic cut to James Stewart going, wait a minute. And he's just, there's no evidence, but his interest is piqued.
Yeah.
And he knows that something has gone on. It's almost the way the movie plays it, as though he knows that these two men who live together have a secret.
Because he's played by Jimmy Stewart, there's no queer energy coming off of him. I think we can say.
Yeah, it's kind of in the text, but Jimmy Stewart isn't really leaning into it at all.
No. Yeah. It's like watching, who was it? Boyd and Charlton Heston.
Stephen Boyd's going for Charlton Heston
in Ben-Hur.
Yeah.
Where, in fact, Stephen Boyd was directed that he and Judah Ben-Hur were lovers when they were teenagers, and he still kind of has feelings for him, but they didn't say that to Charlton Heston.
Because he wouldn't play it. He wouldn't be down with it at all.
They knew he wouldn't be down for it, but it makes the scenes play really, really interestingly.
Yeah, there's dialogue in Rope that seems evocative, and they talks about how, like, John Dahl's character would these are the types of bedtime stories he used to tell at night. And you're saying to yourself, bedtime stories, huh? And there you go. That's sort of evocative without actually coming right out and saying things. But you're right. James Stewart is playing this much more professorial. However, by that point, he doesn't show up until almost a half hour into the movie.
Yeah.
And the movie's great until then. It's not like, oh, thank God. It's actually, in Compulsion, it's kind of interesting because Orson Welles actually, I think, plays is it Clarence Darrow who did that case?
Yes.
Leopold. Yeah, yeah. He shows up about halfway through that movie, and it's like by that point the movie was losing energy. The movie was over. They'd already been arrested. Mm-hmm. I'm waiting for it to whatever, and then all of a sudden Orson Welles shows up, and I'm like, oh, thank God, there's a whole new movie started all of a sudden. There's none of that. Like, John Dahl and Farley Granger are perfectly capable of carrying this whole movie by themselves if Jimmy Stewart had never shown up. But Jimmy Stewart shows up, and yeah, he's until then, it just... Where was I going with this? I had a whole point.
I'm not sure. You're talking about the entrance of the Jimmy Stewart character. I was more professorial than he is a peer of theirs. He's the one who's bringing the philosophy that they're living by, so he actually has a little bit to answer for.
Yeah, no, I forgot where I was going with it. Okay, maybe I'll remember it later.
Well, I'll pick up your fumble.
Thank you. We're leaving it in the show. Here's how the sausage gets made.
Let's go back to queerness for a second here.
Yeah, because I think it was going somewhere in that direction. Okay. I can't remember where.
Yeah, exactly. That you can say that the John Dahl character might have a thing for Jimmy Stewart a little bit, but... regardless of the queerness of the Jimmy Stewart character, he is providing essentially a counterpoint for the queer killer, which was a really unfortunate stereotype in a lot of fiction.
I was waiting to bring this up because while we're talking about how interesting it is that there's a lot of queer coding in this movie, the unavoidable fact is
it created a stereotype. Yeah,
the gay. Well, it didn't create it. I think it was already there, but it codified it. It was made it once again. There was overt.
There was a tendency to make your murder characters in thrillers queer coded, because they represented sort of to the eye of a straight heteronormative audience an aberration. They are morally deviating from ordinary morals, and they are also sexually doing it as well.
And again, if you recall our episode about scare films, this was being preached at the time. This is openly being said that people who are queer are criminals, and that's horrifically wrong, but that was a stereotype.
And out folded into that was also this sort of anti-intellectualism. So you'll see a lot of characters that are murderers, but they're also effete, but they're also kind of insufferable aesthetes. Yeah. And the most recent example of this might be the Hannibal TV series, where Hannibal Lecter, played by Mads Mikkelsen, is very effete. He's kind of effeminate. He's not this big, burly, ultra-masculine man. And these characters...
They also really played up over the course of that series the...
kind of the quote, romance between...
I think it's pretty explicit by the end of the series, actually. I mean, without being... There's actually headlines in the newspapers, murder lovers, that kind of thing. So it's as explicit as it kind of can be without changing the original text of the books.
Not just change it. I don't care. But
they changed quite a bit. I don't know why. I feel like they should have just gone for it even more. But it's pretty open.
Just open mouth kissing right there.
I wish there had been more of it. All right.
But you'll notice as well, as part of this stereotype that has been perpetuated all throughout fiction, that there's a counterpoint to these killer characters, and it's usually the quote heteronormative guy. Mm-hmm. Usually it's two men, but there are female counter versions of this as well.
Mm-hmm. Brad.
Yeah. But they're the ones who are the ones who kind of see the quote deviant character. Mm-hmm. And are a little bit allured by it. There's the seductive element to it. And that's definitely true in Hannibal. And I think that's kind of true here, that there are these characters who are given these masculine counterpoints, and I think that's where the Jimmy Stewart character comes in. He's giving them a counterpart, and he's the one who's realized that he has given them the bad ideas, but there's some sort of moral rot. There's something in you. What is it? Oh, gosh, you're too gay. That's what they're kind of saying with the Jimmy Stewart character. But I'll say this about Rope. Even though the characters are murderers, they're morally reprehensible characters, and they do play into this really unfortunate stereotype of the queer killer, Hitchcock gives them a lot of agency. And I think in showing them just sort of living together in a regular relationship, which reads pretty openly to a modern eye, he's not treating them badly. He's not scapegoating their queerness. He's actually letting the queerness breathe a little bit. And I think I kind of appreciate that about Rogue.
Well, it's interesting because this is one of those instances in which the fact that they are not openly portrayed as queer is this weird, has this weird sense of normalizing their queerness. And so that they feel it actually just really domestic.
Exactly.
And that is
normalizing is the word.
That is interesting. And I think one thing you didn't bring up in great detail, this is, again, this is a generality, but I think it's mostly true. The queer-coded killers in many of the genre films, frankly to this day, but you know, certainly in the past when people couldn't talk about queerness openly in cinema, they very rarely had a lot of screen time.
Yeah,
they were usually not the protagonists of the movie. They usually were just sort of, you know, in the shadows, exerting influence, killing, maybe telling a joke, something. But they didn't. They weren't in, like, literally every shot of the movie like they are in Rope. Except for the credits, but whatever. That's something that is very distinctive, and there's a certain amount of... Again, no one's saying that, you know, nobody can be, like, treated as a murderer in a story. The question is, are you doing it tastefully and ethically? And even tastefully is, you know, arguably not that important, depending on whether or not you've got the right tone. The characters are treated with a lot of respect and dignity, even though they've done a highly immoral thing, the murder part. My issue with Rope, actually, is because I think it's wonderful. I think it's so witty and so biting.
It's a good, wicked, cynical little potboiler.
Again, it's a movie about the fascination with murder, and it sort of is morbid curiosity in movie form. And Hitchcock did a few of those. I think this is one of the better ones. I think it kind of whiffs the ending a little bit. And this is one where I kind of wish I had an opportunity before we did this to read the play, or I don't know if it's ever been filmed as a play, but because I suspect, I know in the play, according to, as you mentioned, I've heard that the queerness is way more explicit, but I wonder if the ending plays the same, because the movie ends with James Stewart finally becoming convinced without having, you know, it's all like incidental evidence and conjecture, like nothing that would hold up in court, that they killed David. And after he proves it, after he looks inside the cabinet, he has a big long speech, and I feel like he mentions his own culpability. He talks about how ashamed he is.
Yeah.
But I feel like there's a lot of production code moralizing at the end there. And it's then I feel like it's the rest of the movie was so thoughtful about how it was handling its ethical issues that I feel like ultimately, because he's like the character who finds the body and like it signals the police in some way, that Jimmy Stewart gets let off the hook, because I feel like the ultimate meat of this story, beyond again, this is in a socio-political or specifically political context, is the idea of what is the ethical responsibility we have for discussion.
And also because he's a professor, there's that classroom element.
Yeah. Well, what are we teaching?
Are we teaching the correct morals to people, or you know, if we're cynical to students, what are we passing on to them?
Yeah, I think it's more ethics than morals, personally, because the idea is you can introduce ideas ethically that you can introduce ideas that are unethical in an ethical way.
Yeah,
if you make them seem titillating or salacious or fascinating or appealing, and they are grotesque and monstrous, then that is an unethical way of presenting them, and James Stewart thought he was in a comfort zone. He thought, okay, everyone understands what I really mean. No, actually. And this is the reason why we need clear dialogue about a lot of the topics that we discuss. We can't just assume the president is joking when they say something horrifying. We actually need a certain amount of decorum, because there will always be someone who thinks to themselves, yeah, the worst possible interpretation, which is what I want them to say, is exactly what's going on. And I'm not saying that wasn't even what the president meant. We all know what I'm talking about. But like, I just feel like that's still relevant. The idea that, you know, when you insert bad ideas, when you insert horrifying or unethical or immoral ideas into a conversation, you have a responsibility to handle them in a moral way. And there's this great conversation in the middle of the movie where Jimmy Stewart is talking about his idea about how it should be okay to kill a waiter if you can't get a table. And a guy's like, okay, but you're joking. And Jimmy Stewart's like, no. At some point, you need to say you're joking. Yeah, you're making everyone really uncomfortable.
Like, I've heard some comedians say that. But they're comedians. They're on stage saying, you know, kind of surprising or shocking things.
Yeah.
Like, who was it? Oh, it was Bill Maher. You know, however you feel about Bill Maher. But he said, you know, he was pro anything death. And then the punchline is like, pro death penalty, pro murder, pro everything. And the punchline was anything to get traffic moving faster. Of course, that's a gag. He's a comedian. Yeah. He's on stage. Whether or not he actually believes that, he can say that in that context.
Right, but that's again, there's an issue of delivery.
But again,
because again, the punchline is that I'm a bad person.
Yeah,
that's the punchline there. Sometimes you watch Bill Maher's show, all he's doing is propagating ugly ideas, and that's just it. That is the joke, is that it's okay to say these things. And on some level, you're just like, at some point, you're just being a dick. It's not even a joke anymore. You're just being a dick now.
As comedians go, just being a dick is kind of his shtick.
I just don't think it's a very good shtick. I don't think it's a lot. I know some comedians talk about it, and again, I'm not advocating for like saying there's, you know, we can't say anything anymore. Of course not. But I do believe that it's okay to criticize someone if they're not coming across well, or if they're encouraging bad ideas.
If they're giving bad.
So like, it's okay to say that's in poor taste, and also there you go.
There's one thing I did like about the ending, though, these are all spoilers for Rope, but
we've already ruined it.
Yeah, Jimmy Stewart finds a pistol and he fires it out the window rather than shooting murderers.
Yeah,
fires it out the window, and in what I think is just this masterful use of sound design, we barely hear coming from the street below. I think I heard some gunshots. I think we need to call the police. I think they came from up there. Like, we know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
While the three main characters are, the camera's still in the room with them, and we just sort of see the hope drain from their bodies.
Yeah, the dialogue stops, and they're just like, well, there's nothing we can do about it now.
Technically, it's a good sequence, but I agree with you that I think Jimmy Stewart having this sort of come to God moment where he's like, no, there needs to be a line somewhere. Like, he just has that revelation. I think he should have that speech. There needs to be a line somewhere. But then I think he needs to sit down and watch the Leopold and Loeb characters carry the body out, and he's just sort of has to live with that.
Yeah.
That he's partly responsible for that.
It ends with him doing something heroic. It should end with him realizing that maybe he's not legally culpable in this, but in his head he knows that he encouraged
it. He kind of caused it.
He is at least directly connected to it. And there's a line in which he talks about his shame, but it's moved on. And I feel like the whole thing with him like shooting out the window, again, I'm not sure if that's the original play or not. I feel like that whole thing is basically just, it's really hard to end this thing with a bang.
Yeah.
We're going to do it literally. Because all he really needs to do is call the cops.
But you want to do something a little bit more dramatic than that.
You want something more dramatic. Boom. It's effective. But it's one of those things where it's actually like, it's also New York. And you realize that, I mean, I'm not saying New York is, you know, there are gunshots on every block, every minute of every day. But it's a big fucking city. And not necessarily anyone is going to know which apartment that came from. It's also pretty high up. It's at least 4 or 5 stories up. So if depending on how many people are on the street at that point in that neighborhood, which doesn't look like terribly trendy, there's a whole bunch of like factories and everything nearby. Who's to say that would even be effective? So it's one of those things that's like, it seems cool, but the more you think about it, the more you realize he actually should have called somebody. He probably should have said something to the effect of, I already called somebody when I was downstairs.
Yeah.
I've been stalling this whole time because I was 100% sure I was.
And
right.
That would have been dramatic too.
Also, it would have been fine. You hear them coming up the walk, hear the knock on the door, boom, credits.
I still think that because this is such a cynical film, it would have benefited from a more cynical ending.
Maybe.
Where Jimmy Stewart realizes that he was in the wrong, and he's kind of, the murder already occurred. It's the first thing that happens in the movie.
Yeah.
And he's helpless now. He's already caused the damage, and turning these people over isn't going to absolve him.
Yeah.
He needs to sit down and really just sort of ponder that while he looks. I think the last shot should have been a shot of David, like the dead David,
the body.
They're like carting him out, or they're stuffing him in a bag or something, and he just has to watch that happen.
Yeah. I wonder if that might have been too gruesome for the production code, though.
Surely it would have been, but that it would have been fitting.
It would have been great. There's a bunch of different ways to end this thing. Again, that's my only real beef with it, is I feel that the ending is... It feels like they're trying to make sure that the grimmer elements of it are in some way ameliorated, and because the rest of the movie was so morbid, it feels like not a total cop-out, but it feels like they didn't quite nail the landing. And that's something that I've actually was watching. I've been watching quite a few Hitchcock movies, well, my whole life, but lately I've seen a few more than usual, and still watching them with my wife and partner, M. Lapis da Silva, and we realized that it's very common for Hitchcock to blow the landing. Some of his movies end perfectly.
Yeah.
Some of his movies are just like, okay, we can get on with it, Hitch. Do we really need the speech at the end of Psycho? Do we really need all of this falling action at the end of Rebecca? The last, like, 15 minutes of Rebecca are just... everything's wrapped up in, like, a thematic or a character perspective, and he just, like, added some plot at the last minute, and now we have to deal with that plot that you added at the last minute. We could speed through that a little. So I feel like this is Hitchcock trying to just make it punchy.
Yeah.
But even that didn't quite work. But in any case, Rope's a neat film.
It's a neat film. I appreciate just its great thriller elements. I appreciate that it's thoughtful about topics like murder. I mean, there's a philosophy to anything. So philosophy
sadly
immoral acts.
Sadly, people are murdered in real life, and it's something that needs to be discussed. And these types of there's a reason why murder is so often a subject in fiction is because it's horrifying and it's fascinating. It doesn't happen to everyone.
Well, and a lot of people fantasize about timelines where murder is permitted, which is why we have characters like James Bond, who, people who do commit murder for heroic reasons.
Well, hell, there's a speech in this movie where James Stewart's talking about, okay, we can't have murder all the time because then no one would get anything done. What if we just had a holiday where people are allowed to murder people, and you can just see the creators of The Purge like going, interesting, maybe I'll write a script about that.
Maybe I'll write a series of movies.
Yeah, and they'll be really good, actually. You
know, one and a half of them will be good.
Oh, shush.
Purge Election Year is awesome.
Purge Election, I think the last three Purge movies are great. I think the first Purge movie would be fine if it wasn't the first. Because the whole point of The Purge is that if you're not familiar, we're talking about The Purge is a series of horror movies about this like very near future in America where they've instituted this national holiday where for one night everyone's allowed to kill if they want to. And it's a way of keeping the population down and also a very specific way of, because rich white people can afford to like barricade themselves in fancy houses at night. It's, it's very political and it's very much about how various government and economic policies are designed to keep very specific groups of people down. The first movie was all about the rich white people barricading themselves in the house.
It was a home invasion movie. Yeah. It was badly shot.
It's not great, but it's
a fun concept, but a pretty bad movie.
Well, the problem with that movie is that you're starting off the franchise with the least interesting characters. For me, the most interesting characters are the people who are stuck outside in The Purge.
Yeah.
Who can't afford to barricade themselves into a fancy house. People who are, and this is what we see in The Purge Anarchy, it's what we see in Purge Election Year, it's what we see in the first Purge. I feel like if you wanted to do the, like, rich conservative family that's been profiting off of the misery of others and realizes that it's wrong, that's what you do, like, the fifth Purge movie when interest has, like, waned a little bit and, like, now we have a smaller budget, but hey, there's this one thing we never really talked about. It's like, what happens if it gets twisted around and what's that going to be like? The sort of irony, oh God, I realized all of these policies that I've been supporting actually are horrible if they happen to me. Like, that might have been interesting, like, as a much later afterthought.
Yeah.
But starting with it was always a bad idea. And I think I'm kind of amazed that they were able to do more after that. But I'm glad they did, because those other ones are cool.
But that's The Purge. That's neither here nor there.
Well, it's similar, because we're talking about, like, talking about murder and talking about these sort of ideas about sort of what happens when you realize that a lot of the rules we live by as a society, what if we stopped enforcing them?
Yeah.
Dangerous. But anyway, that's Rope. Excellent film. Pretty readily available. Please check it out if you haven't already. Good old Rope.
It's quite good.
Yeah.
And the the context of freeing and normalizing extreme criminal queer characters is something that was Rocky Horror was very heavily influenced by.
Yeah, very, very much so. So basically, like, this is like almost like Rope, but now we get to say all the quiet parts loud and sing about
them. And in music, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, next week on Critically Acclaimed. Next
this is,
week
this
on
is episode zero.
I'm leaving it in. This one's my flub. I think they're all my flubs. But next week, we realize that we've been talking about a topic and we haven't necessarily done the best job of giving a baseline reading of it. So next week, while we're on the subject of queerness in classic Hollywood, we're going to be talking about an iconic documentary really, you know, its popularity helped change the conversation about a lot of classic Hollywood films. We're going to be talking about The Celluloid Closet, which is just a documentary about queerness in Hollywood.
Queerness in Hollywood up through when the film was made, which was 1995. Mm-hmm. So there's been a lot of changes since then, and I'd love to see a sequel to The Celluloid Closet.
I think it's overdue, yeah.
But yeah, a lot of the early depiction of queerness as depicted in The Celluloid Closet are still really applicable, and the way queer characters were coded, weren't coded, were depicted, and attitudes towards gayness were handled by film over the years.
So if you're interested in the conversation we just had about Rope and the way that Rope handled queerness, The Celluloid Closet is very much like a sort of a broad overview of a lot of the gay coding that was happening in Hollywood over the decades. It's an acclaimed documentary. Thank God it's still available. Sometimes a lot of these like really iconic Hollywood documentaries are not readily available. Visions of Light.
That's straight up BS, man.
That needed a Blu-ray release. I don't know if maybe the clips are too expensive, but like that needed like a 4K release like a long ass time ago. It's a great documentary about the art of cinematography. It's wonderful. But Celluloid Closet is available, so we'll be doing that next week on episode zero. Thank you everybody for listening to episode zero. Again, we'll be back next week. Celluloid Closet, blah blah blah. We've got a whole bunch of stuff, don't we? We've got Twitter. We're on Twitter at Critic Acclaim. I'm at Lane Viviani.
I'm at Whitney Seibel.
If you want to talk about anything we discussed on this episode or any other topic in particular, you're more than welcome to write us an email. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We would love to hear from you. We might read your email in an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail. We have a Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, where we have a ton of exclusive content, including podcasts dedicated to Star Trek, Batman, Disney, the Academy Awards, commentary tracks, and the like. We also, well, not Whitney, but M. Lopez de Silva, my wife and partner, and I, we have a soap business now over on Etsy. If you go to Salt Cat Soap, you can check out a whole line of distinct and really cool soaps. All of them that are on the site right now are designed and made by M. Lopez de Silva. I might have a few throughout the year. We just released a whole bunch of new designs for Valentine's Day, including one that is my very favorite scent I've ever smelled. They're called breakup bars. They look like hearts that have been like broken in half. It's Valentine's Day type offer, and we have a few of those, and it smells like dark chocolate and orange, and it's so good. It's so good, you guys.
You like those chocolate oranges, the crack open ones you get in your Christmas stocking?
My favorite cookie ever is a cookie. It's called Pim's, and it's like a chewy wafer and a thin layer of dark chocolate and then just like orange jam in the middle.
Yeah.
Just, I could eat those all day. And you'd be like, hey, what happened to this lifetime supply of Pim's that we had this morning? And I would be like, oh, I ate those because they're that good. anyway, I love that one. But we have a bunch of really, really cool stuff. Some of them are like super fancy and they're all really, really pretty. And one of them is also inspired by our cat Luca. And if you go to, I'll try to retweet it. My Twitter, we did a little video of me yelling at Luca to get off the counter, but it's one of the Luca bars.
Mm.
Really cute. But that's over there too. So that's on our Etsy store, Salt Cat Soap. And we'll be back with Celluloid Closet, and now we're done.
Thanks for listening.
I see you shiver with Antissa. Patient.